Well, now to a tome of a book, and I mean that quite literally. It's a new 600-page history of ancient Rome, SPQR, Senatus Populus Quae Romanus. That's an abbreviation for the Senate and People of Rome. It comes from the renowned scholar Professor Mary Beard of Cambridge. She's also the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement and made famous with her various BBC series, a genuine luminary scholar of our times. Now, I say a, quotes, new history because it differs from other accounts in that it debunks some of the givens we've been led to believe about this turbulent period of history, particularly that notion of the decline and fall of Rome. And maybe she joins the ranks of the disruptors. I'll ask her because she's going to set us straight from her home now in the UK. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Mary.
Hello, hello.
Do you think of yourself as one of the disruptors, I wonder?
Yeah, I think I've always thought of myself as a disruptor. And I think in some ways that makes you a kind of distinctive sort of historian. And what I'm trying to do in this book, really, is actually debunk quite a lot of myths. One of the myths I've tried to debunk is that the Romans sat down around a map in the 3rd century BC and they decided to conquer the world, and they had a grand plan for imperial takeover. And I want to say, look, they really didn't. In some ways, this was an empire almost, I don't mean to let them off the hook here, but it was an empire almost by accident, and they couldn't have sat around by a map in the 3rd century BC because they didn't have any maps, right? So there's a kind of unplannedness to the Roman Empire that I think we've got to take for granted.
And yet you do say, if I read you correctly, that it was power over increasingly far-flung parts that drove all sorts of changes, revolutionary changes, inside Rome itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about Rome, there is no doubt that Roman expansion was brutal and horrible and it killed hundreds and thousands of people. And, it's very hard to stand up for the Romans in that way. On the other hand, one of the things it does is it alters, and I think this is what is, I think, interesting for us, the expansion of Rome alters the way the Romans think about themselves. And we have here what is in the West, though we shouldn't forget China in the East, but what is in the West, the first claims to a global empire. And we have with that both the appalling side of that, which is, brutality and conquest and all the rest. We also have something which changes the Western world forever. We have an idea that the world is joined up, that Spain and Greece are part of the same political community. Now, look, in the EU, we're still trying to make that the case. So there is a kind of political edge to this for us, because Rome did join up the Mediterranean, it did join up Europe, and there were big costs to that, but we've never managed it. No one ever since has ever managed it.
Very interesting way of thinking about it. How did Rome, this tiny, unremarkable village in central Italy, as you describe it, how did it emerge then as the seat of such power?
Well, that's, I think, the big question. And people often get very, very interested in how Rome fell. How did the Roman Empire, which dominated the Western world for hundreds of years, how did it fall? I think in some ways a much more interesting question is, how did it actually rise? And that's very hard to say. And what I try to argue in the book, and I think here again there's something for us now, is that Rome was different from every other culture in the ancient Mediterranean because it incorporated into citizenship, into a kind of full part of the Roman community, the people that it conquered. I think Rome's openness and incorporation of citizens is the one thing that makes it paradoxically the successful empire.
And yet you caution us about being too glib about what it, to use this word Roman as an adjective, you know, what was Roman Christianity, what was Roman Britain. You're wary of being too cute about this.
Yes. I mean, I think you've got to be very careful about this. It's one of the things that's interesting about Rome is that it's somehow kind of in our cultural DNA. You know, we think about Rome in our terms, quite rightly, but we always have to just kind of be careful about somehow thinking that you can just map on the Roman experience to ours. You don't need the Romans to tell us that big invasions of Afghanistan are a bad idea. You have to be careful about seeing the Romans as a lesson for us. But I think what the Romans are and the way they expanded into what is our Western and partly non-Western world, they do kind of bring us up short and they say, hey, you know, think about whether this kind of domination is possible. Think about what it means to have a world which includes Iran and Afghanistan and Britain and Germany and Spain. You know, they bring us up short and make us say, hang on a minute. You know, if I could have one thing that I would make a plea for the Romans, it wouldn't be that there's a lesson for us. It would be that if you read them, they're constantly saying to you, hang on a minute, think a bit more carefully about what you're doing.
Well, interestingly, Mary Beard, it's funny because I thought in a way you were trying to, you said just then, you were rebutting that notion of the inevitable decline into depravity of absolute power, which is what I, and you're saying, look, we've got to dwell a little bit more into when they were extraordinarily powerful and why. I mean, don't they also show us it can be done in a way?
They show us that it can and they show us the costs of that. You know, they're a very good mirror for us, though they're not a lesson for us. And I think that the thing that I felt most when I was writing the book was that, you know, one way we look at the Romans as, you know, people who built roads, built bridges, conquered the world, you know, what the Romans ever done for us.
Yes.
And, you know, that's part of it, you know, and I'm not going to knock that, actually. But also, Roman writers are the best critics of that too. Now, when someone like Tacitus, writing in the 2nd century AD, can look at the consequences of Roman conquest and say, as he did, they make a desert and they call it peace. You know, I don't think that anybody since has ever been any more snappy in summing up the downside of what imperial conquest means. They're very good at seeing it both ways. That's why they're interesting.
And Mary Beard is my very welcome guest on Saturday Extra today, I'm delighted to say. And we're talking about her latest work for a few months before the something new, SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. Look, I was intrigued, I must say, among many things, with the gods they chose. You say that Roman religion was not only polytheistic, but it treated foreign gods much as it treated foreign peoples by incorporation. And then you go on to describes how Judaism, for instance, remarkably lived within Roman culture. But for the Romans, Christianity was an incredible challenge. Why so?
You know, it's one of the big questions, you know, big historical questions of all time. And I think it's Romans had problems with the Jews, and the Jews had even more problems with the Romans. But there was a way in which Rome, with all its many gods, polytheism, et cetera, managed to make an accommodation with Judaism. Not always, but mostly. Now, it is very interesting to look at how they failed to do that with Christianity, or Christianity failed to do that with them. And it's quite hard to see absolutely why that is. But you can see some factors in this. And one is that, and this is to draw a distinction with Jews, Jews did animal sacrifice. There was a way in which basic central ritual of Roman and Jewish religion was something that you could make similar. You were sacrificing an animal to the gods. Now, first of all, Christianity absolutely refused to do that.
Mm.
So you find a religion in which the sacrificial moment is only in the sacrifice of Jesus.
Can I just interrupt you, dare I say? You also, because this is what really got to me, that the Romans expected deities to be from somewhere. Isis from Egypt, Mithras from Persia,
the Jewish, but the Christian
God was rootless and claimed to be universal. Boy, that's a challenge, isn't it?
So you have to add on to what I've just been saying, that particular point. So Jewish religion was Judaic, from Judea, and the Romans could see that. What Christianity did was not so much, although it was in part, you know, a rejection of polytheism, a rejection of the sacrifice. It just claimed to be universal. It claimed to be not from anywhere. It claimed to speak to anybody. And the paradox of that is, and I think this is what's really nice about the whole idea of the Roman Empire, is that it was only the Roman Empire and the connectivity and the communication networks of the Roman Empire that enabled Christianity to thrive. The Christians needed the Roman Empire, but the message they had was one that entirely countered the whole basis of what the Roman Empire stood for. So it was a wonderful paradox until the Roman emperors decided to
take them on,
actually make a compact with Christianity.
Oh, it was Constantine. Yes, it's sort of the chaos of human life writ large, that whole story, isn't it, in a way?
What you're saying.
All the big guns get a mention in your book, you know, Hannibal, Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, Augustus, Nero, Caligula and so on. But you've deliberately introduced us to people whose voices aren't usually present, I think. Mm. Women, slaves and conspirators. The ones who, I mean, is it fair to say they came off second best? I think we think they came off 10th best, but you're challenging that a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I want to say, look, the history of no people is any good if all you do is look at the rich. Roman writing is dominated by the writing of, you know, very rich and very privileged people. And they're very interesting, but they're one view. And what I've tried to do is to put that together. You can't get rid of that. That's how Roman history is. But you can say, let's think. Can we see a different version of this?
Mm.
And the more you look, the more you do get glimpses of that. One of my favourite stories in the book is the guy who, when in this great civil wars of the late Republic in the 1st century BC, Caesar, Julius Caesar, is thrashing Pompey the Great. You suddenly get the story of the guy who, after the big battle, picked up, this is an ordinary trader, and he picked up Pompey and gave him a lift, to safety. And you think, look, actually, within this big story of Rome and big Roman people, there are stories of little guys who give big guys lifts and who wonder about the world. And you can partly see. And I want to bring them back into the picture, if I can. And I think I can a little bit.
Some of the descriptions of the way the wealthy lived are very amusing. The resonance with the present day is very interesting. But maybe we should draw to a close by just asking you to reflect on why you chose to tell your story starting in 63 BCE, and then you end it in 212 AD at the end of the first Roman millennium, which is not when we usually consider the end of the Roman Empire. Why did you choose both of those?
I started in 63 BC because it's the first time that you actually get a really rich eyewitness description, more than you can deal with, really, of what's going on in Rome. So that was why I chose 63. 212 was a kind of much more brave decision, actually, because one of the themes of the book is saying, look, interesting thing about Rome is the way it defines citizenship, the way it lets people in, the way it incorporates. And in 212 AD, and it's a terribly forgotten moment, the Emperor Caracalla, who's a nasty piece of work in many ways, decides that every free inhabitant of the Roman Empire will be a full citizen.
From Scotland to Syria, you say?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's a kind of that whatever Caracalla's motives, someone suspects they might not have been entirely liberal. We don't know anything about them. But that's a changing moment in the history of the world. And it's the one we've forgotten.
Yes, they did, of course, then subsequent, as you say, fundamentally took away the boundary between rulers and the ruled, but they did set up subsequently other clear hierarchies, which we'll just have to leave people to discover when they read your book. I do want...
There is a sad sequel. As I intimate, what happens over the next 200 years is that they invent more and more dividers between the privileged and the non-privileged. But all the same, particularly right now with the problems of the EU, I'd like to celebrate a moment in which somebody could say, for whatever motive, everybody, Spain to Syria, the Sahara to wherever, they're all full Roman citizens. That's quite a moment to look back to.
You're about to do another BBC series, I see, a follow-up to the earlier Meet the Romans, which was just fabulous to watch. And you're contributing to another BBC series on the story of art, picking up on the original Kenneth Clarke Civilization series.
Yeah. Exciting.
Very.
Exciting.
And that's you,
and
Simon.
Very daunting.
You, Simon Sharma, and David Olusoga.
Olusoga.
Yes.
So, look, the original 1960s Kenneth Clarke was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but it was very European and it didn't go back to the ancient world.
And are you including China in this?
We are.
Good.
Yes,
good.
We are. I really do want to look more widely. You know, how could anybody in 2016 say that civilization was only European? It's mad. No.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, good luck. That is a worthy challenge.
I need a lot of good luck.
Even for you. Look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed, and I hope we can talk again.
Yeah, thank you very much.
The incomparable Mary Beard. She's Professor of Classics at Newnham College, Cambridge, one of those true British polymaths. She's also the Classics Editor of the Times Literary Supplement, and her latest book is SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome, published by Profile Books. And if you really have time, just go onto the web and look for all her various television outings as well. They're quite something.